There are really some projects that definitely are underfunded because the mechanism of competition for fundraising induces the NGOs systematically to undercover those projects.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. NGOs have to compete with each other for the donations they need, so it would be surprising if this didn't affect their choices of where and on what to put their focus. Thierry Verdier of the Paris School of Economics is one of a team of researchers analysing the competition for fundraising and its impact. Thierry, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Hello, team.
During the last couple of decades, has the NGO sector been growing in importance for development?
Yes, definitely. The NGO sector has been growing. For instance, if you just look, for instance, at the period from 2004 to 2012, there was a massive increase in OECD aid channeled through NGOs. In terms of the fraction of official development aid, it grew from 2004, 3% to more than 13% in 2012. And if you look at more recent data of the World Bank, it suggests that for projects that involve, in one way or another, civil society, the share of the projects went from 6% in the late 80s to more than 70% by the mid-2000s. So definitely there's a typical increase in the NGO sector and development.
And this is massive growth. Has it been across the board in development, or has it tended to focus in a few sectors?
No, it has tended to focus on a few sectors. Really, we do observe several types of clustering of NGO projects. The first type of clustering is really in terms of some sectors have benefited much more than other sectors from NGO aid. We looked in the paper at some data, which is the aid data too, that basically systematizes the data on virtually all development aid projects where you have some involvement of public funding from the OECD countries. And we concentrated on projects where NGOs were the major implementation channel, and for the period 93 to 2013. And what we found is that basically sectors like the health, education, agriculture, and rural development, they accounted for more than 10% each of those projects, while at the same time, other projects such as environment-related projects account barely for 3%, while transportation, communication, and construction only for 1.75%. So there are really some projects that are getting much more funding than others, and some sectors that are getting much more funding than others. And if you get even sort of in the final investigation of the types of projects that are attracting a lot of funding, you realize that, for instance, projects that involve child sponsorship or microcredit services, they are definitely the ones that are of the majority. If you get even sort of deeper into the classification and look, for instance, at a sector like the emergency response and reconstruction or disaster prevention sector, you realize that the lion's share of projects, 62%, goes to material relief assistance and services, while at the same time, reconstruction and rehabilitation is only about 6%. So this is really a tremendous clustering, even at the final definition of projects analysis. The health sector is also a typical sector where we think that NGOs are very much involved, and their HIV and AIDS is a major sector, while malaria and tuberculosis control is also a very neglected sector in related to the funding.
Now, does this also mean that some countries or regions within countries, they also do disproportionately well as beneficiaries of this aid?
That's true. Really, there are some countries that are benefiting much more than others and regularly. Again, looking at the same data, the aid data too, we found that among the top 10 beneficiaries for that period of 93-2013, Ethiopia and India are always among the top 10 beneficiaries, while Kenya and Uganda come second very often, and other countries are much less considered in terms of distribution of aid. So it's very skewed somehow. And if you look even finer at the final level in terms of within countries, at the regional level, it's well documented that in countries like Uganda, Bangladesh, or Cambodia, there is quite some systematic concentration of projects in particular regions. In Tanzania, for instance, many projects are clustered in the region of Arusha or Dar es Salaam, which are incidentally the regions with the lowest relative poverty rates in the country. So that suggests that the correlation between development issues and regional concentration of projects of NGOs is not necessarily always positive.
But surely, Thierry, this doesn't even make sense for the NGOs themselves, because they're competing for fundraising in the same places and with the same projects. And that means that they're cutting a finite donor pie into smaller pieces.
Yes, that's related to the incentive they face in terms of the fundraising market. Essentially, what we do in this work, we present a framework in which we analyze what are the incentives for NGOs to execute cluster on typical projects. And we identify three mechanisms, three effects that basically determine this clustering. The first one is what we call a positive activation effect, namely that NGOs, when they have a common voice on a typical single issue, they tend to attract much more attention of the donors, and that's raising some awareness more easily. So that's what we could call an awareness raise. Spillover effects across NGOs. And that effect per se, of course, tends to induce NGOs to cluster on the same projects. At the same time, as you say, clustering also has a competitive effect. That is, that you sort of share a common pie of funds among different NGOs, so you break it. And so that's a direct donation competition effect, which goes the opposite way. And we identify as well a third effect, which is that basically by clustering on the same issues, NGOs anticipating their competition on fundraising, somehow it's a mechanism by which they can smoothen their competition. So strategically, they can soften the fundraising competition by clustering on similar projects. So that's what we call an implicit fundraising coordination effect. And the combination of those three effects basically generate whether or not we will get this possibility for clustering on the fundraising market. Whether the two positive effects for clustering overcome the negative effect, the competitive effect, depends on two major parameters. The first one is the degree of issue specificity of donors. The share of donors who are attached to one specific issue, to donate to one specific issue, rather than donate more generally for development. And second, the cost of fundraising and raising up awareness of donors, typically the importance of the media and the media bias with which you can raise the awareness of donors on specific issues.
And does this now also then mean that there are Cinderella projects and regions that just don't get funded or are very much underfunded? Are there examples of that?
Well, I mean, for instance, in the environment-related projects, typically, as I said, I mean, there are some projects that are very underfunded, like, for instance, site preservation or food prevention. They reflect, again, in our data, only 1% of the projects on that sector, that environment-related projects that get those funds. So there are really some projects that definitely are underfunded because the mechanism of competition for fundraising induces the NGOs systematically to undercover those projects.
Yes, I remember when we interviewed Stefan Durkon of the Blavatnik School, previously of the UK's Department for International Development. He specialises in research on aid when there are disasters. And his argument was that assistance after an emergency attracts donors to NGOs, but that tends not to be the best use of those resources, which would be better at, well, preventing the disasters in the first place. Is this the sort of thing you're talking about?
Yes, I do agree completely. The typical example for that is the Indian Ocean tsunami. In that particular case, it's well documented that NGOs sort of rushed for emergency on specific emergency activities and relief activities, while at the same time, whenever the crisis was sort of over, very few NGOs sort of got involved into post-emergency reconstruction work projects, which are particularly important, of course, for the recovery of the region. And so this is illustrating really much this bias. That's another type of the dimension of clustering, which is this temporal clustering dimension that NGOs tend to all rush at the same time on very few projects, and then afterwards they don't sort of smooth out the way the allocation of aid could be done over the period to help the country to recover and construct.
So let's think about what we can do about this, Thierry. Is there another equilibrium within your framework in which all these hundreds of thousands of NGO projects could better reflect the need that we have?
One way to do that will be to promote the coordination of NGOs on fundraising activities. There are already some institutional structures that sometimes NGOs by themselves develop to try to commit to particular allocation of fundraising and efforts on various projects. The question, of course, is the credibility of insurance structures, whether or not NGOs are able to credibly commit to coordinate their fundraising efforts on a diverse set of projects. And this is not always the case. There are typical examples that we mentioned in the paper. For instance, one of them is the Ethiopian famine in 1984, where because it was highly publicized in the media, there's one large NGO, World Vision, that basically entered in competition with another set of NGOs, the SEC, the Australian Council of Churches, and breaking an explicit agreement not to compete at Christmas time for the traditional ACC Christmas Bowl appeal. And typically, it was the incentive was too strong for World Vision at the moment, at a specific time of Christmas, to and mediatization of the famine in Ethiopia, to just create a campaign to raise funding for that particular project, therefore inducing inefficient competition with the ACC. So that's really a question, how NGOs can by themselves construct credible institutions to coordinate their fundraising efforts and allow the financing of diverse projects. In that sense, I guess that the government somehow might help by creating incentives or regulating somehow the entry or producing some incentives for NGOs to finance projects by themselves, not attracting naturally, easily the attention of the media.
One problem is that donors will very often specify exactly how their funds should be used. You can understand why that happens. But should NGOs maybe target donors who don't specify how the money's used? Or should we encourage donors not to specify that, so when the funding comes in, then it can be allocated efficiently?
The problem is exactly that. It's exactly in that particular situation where the share of donors who are not particularly attracted to any specific type of project is large, that incentives for NGOs to compete will generate more clustering. Because the idea is exactly when you have donors who are not specific to one particular issue, you want to attract them to your issue. And so if that's the issue that is easier to manage in the fundraising competition because there's media bias or attention, then everybody's going to run on this. And the donors that have specific warm glows to give for other projects, they will not be activated. They will not be aware of what is going on for their own projects. So that's exactly the typical problem is exactly those donors who are not specific to any kind of project. They are too much of fruit to be collected by the NGOs. And so they all rush on those donors. And if actually the media situation is such that it's easier to attract their attention on one specific project, they will all go for that project. So in a sense, I will agree that intuitively we will think that having donors who are not specifically attracted to one particular type of project will allow for diversification of fundraising on projects. But at the end, the incentives on the market sort of go the other way for the NGOs themselves.
You mentioned the role of governments here. So is there ultimately a role for policymakers, governments to exert some control over where and how NGOs can spend their money? Would that work?
This is a two-edged kind of situation. On one hand, we could think that eventually a benevolent government will provide the credibility for the NGOs to create institutions that allow them to coordinate on a diversified set of projects. At the same time, as we always know, governments, when they enter into the picture, and that's the reason why we have non-governmental organizations, is that they have their own political agenda. So the question, of course, is that you have to compare what is the bias that comes from the NGO competitive sector against the bias that might appear through the intervention of governments in the way they will sort of induce the financing of diverse projects through NGOs. That's one way or the other, depends on the situation, and there's no definite answer in that problem.
These are difficult and important questions, and as you say, there are no easy answers, are there? Thierry, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you very much, Tim.
Now, if you want to read more about this, then I would recommend the paper that Thierry and his co-authors have recently published in the Economic Journal in August 2020. It's called Samaritan Bundles, Fundraising Competition and Inefficient Clustering in NGO Projects. And the authors are Ghani Aldashev, Marco Marini and Thierry Verdier. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. If you enjoyed it, subscribe on your podcast platform, whether that's Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whatever you use, and you'll never miss one of our episodes. Or if you have missed our episodes, well, you can always find past episodes at voxdev.org.